We've been going through, of course, a series of sermons on holiness and a lot of in-depth study of the Old Testament and the study of the of Hagios in the New Testament, the Greek concept of holiness and sanctification. And we've been going through that now for four sermons. And, of course, there's about six more sermons to go in this series. But I thought we'd take a little break today and do something very simple. A very simple subject, but a very practical subject. Sometimes it's easy to forget to go back to certain very practical concepts and very simple ideas, and sometimes we need to go back and do that. Let's go to Luke 16 as our starting point. I'm going to read this from the NIV. It's not necessarily from the NIV, because the NIV is a much better translation of this passage. It's just easier to read because of the way they translated it into the story style that they did. But this passage has actually created a lot of confusion at times at exactly what Jesus was saying. Yet if we look through it, the point he's making is very important for all of us. Verse 1 says of Luke 16, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager anymore. In other words, I hear you are sloppy. I hear that you're incompetent, that you're even dishonest. And I'm going to fire you. So bring the books. Now he knows the books are going to show that he's incompetent and dishonest. So he has a decision. What is he going to do? Verse 5. Well, let's go verse 3. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me back into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors, and called the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. And he said to the second, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. And he replied, and he told him, take your bill, and make it 800. Now, what he's doing here is he's setting himself up for success when he loses his job. He's setting himself up so that everybody will say, you know, you were a good guy. You treated me really well. I hear you're out of work. You come work for me. When I worked in radio, it was interesting in the big markets. I hated working in big markets. I love small market radio. Because small market radio, you interact with the business people and you're part of the community. In a big market like Austin, and I actually saw this happen in Austin once. In a big market like Austin, everything's based on the ratings. So, you're number one. And what happens is the next Arbitron comes out, and you drop to number three or four. And you always have these salesmen that sell the advertising, the radio ads. They realize where they're going to lose customers because they drop from number one to number four. So what they do is they go around and they go to the other station that just went to number one, and they tell them, I'm the number one salesman, you want me. And usually they'll gobble them up. You know why? Because they're going to bring all their accounts. And they go to all their accounts and say, hey, I'm leaving. I'm leaving because we're not number one anymore, we're number four. And they actually leave by stripping the business from the very company maybe they worked for 5 years. And they literally just strip everything from them and just almost drive them into bankruptcy. Stations have been destroyed simply because, now, it's very interesting because maybe the next Arbitron, they're number one again. Well, you can't do that more than once. You get to play that game one time. And then everybody figures out, wait a minute, how can I trust you? If you would do that to your employer, how can I trust you with my account? But it happens all the time. That's what this guy's doing. He's figured out, I'm going to get fired, so at the expense of my employer, I'm going to get in good with all the accounts. Now, what Jesus says here is what people misunderstand. In verse 8, he says, the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. People say, well, wait a minute. How's he making the good guy here, or the bad guy, the good guy? You'll see Jesus do this quite a bit, What he does is he takes a person that is a bad guy and uses them for a point. I mean, my favorite is when he uses the Samaritans as a good guy. Because the Jewish society, there was no one more despicable than Samaritans. Because they weren't pure pagans like Romans. They were people who worshipped Yahweh. They worshipped the God of Israel, but in a pagan way. They were absolute outcasts in society. And he kept using them as the good guys. So he would always do this. He'd take a bad guy and turn just because he was making the point so strongly. And the point he's making here, okay, this isn't a good guy, but the owner says, you know what, that was pretty smart. You cost me something, but now everybody's going to give you a job. Of course, the only problem with that is the owner knows, usually the accounts too, and he goes around and sits down with everybody and says, hey, this guy's just taking advantage of me. So he goes on, and Jesus says, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Wait, what's he saying here? I mean, there's many places where Jesus talks about the misuse of wealth. So why is he saying use physical wealth so that you can use it wisely so that you can have eternal dwellings? What he's saying, and we'll see this in a minute as we go through the next few verses, he's telling his disciples, look, what you need to do is learn how to use what you have. Learn how to use what you have. Learn how to take care of what you have. Because how you deal with your physical things, your physical wealth, your physical belongings, tells God something and is a revelation of your own character. Remember, a revelation of your own character. As we'll see, this has nothing to do with how much you have. He's not saying, if you're wealthy, you're a better Christian. That's not what he's saying. Any more than he says, if you're poor, you're a better Christian. Yeah, sometimes we think that way. People say, well, if you're wealthy, God's blessing you, you must be a better Christian. And then you hear poor people say, well, God loves the poor, he hates the rich, so we're a better Christian. What you have is really zero importance in terms of who you are as a Christian. It is what you do with what you have. Notice what he says here. He drives home this point in verse 10 where he says, whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? So he stops and he says, okay, so here's my point. Jesus, my point is, God learns about us and the character we develop and the godliness and the righteousness and how we use the things that we have. Now, we don't usually think of it that way. But he says, so be very careful on how you use wealth. And then the next statement, it's interesting how he does this. He makes this statement, and then, because people would take this and say, ooh, I need to go out and make lots of money, so I'll have lots of things to work with. So he says here in the next statement, no servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. This is who you serve. He's not talking about what you have. There's people in the Bible, Abraham was a very wealthy man. There's other people in the Bible, Elijah, during the drought in Israel, was so poor, he lived in somebody's house and God had to give them food every day. So, obviously, where you are on this status of wealth is not important to God. What you do with what you have is important. And it's important that we cannot serve money. And this is important to our society. You know, there's a lot in the Bible that is mentioned and written to wealthy people. And we say, well, I hope all the millionaires in the room are listening. If you have electricity, and you have a roof over your head, and you have indoor plumbing, and your belly's full every day, you're better off than about 50% of the people of the world. We are the wealthy of the world. So we equate wealth with the super wealthy. We equate wealth with the super wealthy. But with most people in the world, you and I are wealthy. Because we have more than what most people have. So we have to step back and realize that when he's talking about wealthy many times, we fit that. We fit what he's talking about. I mean, most of us have a television set. Most of us have a car. We have things that we take for granted that just 50, 60 years ago were issue or status of wealth. Those things meant you were wealthy. You know, that back in, if you just go back to the time of World War II, most people did not have a car, right? Because they could afford it. He goes on, he says, the Pharisees, verse 14, I love the way Luke throws this in here, who loved money. Remember, Luke is gathering the information. Luke wasn't there. And Luke gathers the information from all these sources, and he says, whoa, did they love money? Of course, he's being inspired by God, too. But this is a little commentary if there's in it. Who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. And he said to them, you're the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of men, but God knows your heart. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight. He says, what you think is important in your desire for status and wealth is meaningless to God. So we have a very important point here being taught by Jesus Christ, in that when we look at what we own, we may think it's not important to God, but we have to realize that it is, in terms of how he uses wealth to help develop in us certain spiritual attributes. What I'm going to go through is five spiritual attributes that are affected by your money. You know, there's always a joke that, you know, a minister can talk about anything but money. He talks about money, that's it. The congregation won't listen. But there are five spiritual attributes that are affected by money. And then I'm going to take just a little time at the end, and I'm going to go through a few biblical instructions about, and practical instructions, on how to get control of your money. Because I talk to, you know, more and more counseling I do has to do with loss of job, loss of income, difficulty because of inflation. You know, money problems are going to get worse in our society. So we have to be able to face this and understand it. First of all, the very first spiritual attribute of your life that is affected by money is your faith. Now, we're going to go to the Proverbs a lot. We'll turn to some of them, and some of them I'm just going to read to you. But we're told it in Proverbs 3. Honor the Lord, this is verse 9 and 10, honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. God expects us, through tithes and offerings, to offer this to God of our wealth. And anytime we're in a difficult situation, that's one of the most difficult things to do. I know that, you know that. And yet, what that shows is when you and I have difficulty honoring God in a way that we believe we should with our wealth, but we don't, it's because of, it's a faith issue. Tithing is a faith issue. Giving an offering is a faith issue. Because it doesn't mean a lot. If you're really, really wealthy and don't need the money and you give an offering to God, it doesn't mean that much. It's when you don't have much, you have to say, wow, if I give something, I sacrifice, which is interesting, it's what the word sacrifice means. I sacrifice. Now it means something. And it becomes a matter of faith. It's interesting in Deuteronomy, we won't go there, but in Deuteronomy chapter 8, God told ancient Israel, I'm going to give you this land. And, you know, they've been slaves. They had no wealth. They lived in poverty. Then they crossed the Sinai Desert as nomads. And he says, I'm about to give you a land that you can't even believe. This land, you're going to have your own houses. You're going to have your own land. You're going to be able to grow your own food. You're going to have flocks of your own. You're going to live in a luxury you can't dream of. And I'm going to give this to you. And you're going to be wealthy. And he said, but here's the great danger, he tells him. He said, when you're settled into that land, your houses are built, and you're growing your food, everything's going just fine. He said, when you get to that state, you will forget who gave you the wealth. The privilege to have wealth is from God. Now, lots of people use dishonesty to grab it, okay? And that's an issue between them and God. Now, there's many places in the Bible, you know, even David said, I don't understand this, God. How come this person gets blessed and I don't? And, of course, God's answer always was, well, they took the blessing by force, or they took the blessing through dishonesty, or they grabbed this blessing by hurting somebody else. Sooner or later, they deal with me. So why don't you stop worrying about that? Stop worrying about these people who do this because of dishonesty or because they lie or because they cheat. Eventually they deal with me. Let's think about you. Let's deal with you. And you see that all through the Bible. And of course we deal with that too. Why does this person get the promotion? Why does this person get the raise? When they were dishonest. Or they did something wrong. Or they were willing to compromise. And God says, I'll deal with that. Let's deal with you. Now that now becomes an issue of faith. I must believe that God gives the right to have wealth, and God will take care of me. Now, God taking care of us. There's a lot of panic among people today, and it's in the church too, about the way the world is going. And people are in this state of panic about, what if the economy collapses? What if this happens? What if that happens? It's just constant. You know, if you listen to talk radio, it'll drive you nuts after a while. Literally crazy. Because we live in fear. Everybody lives in fear. There's a point in time where we all have to decide, God will take care of me. Now, I didn't say he will give you everything you desire. All I can tell you is, I've dealt with a lot of people in 35 years of the ministry. I've seen people obey God and live in poverty. But I've never seen a person obey God and starve to death. I've never seen it happen. I've never seen a person who obeyed God go around naked. I've seen them wear used clothing. I've never seen them go around naked. It wasn't what we always desire, right? I always tell stories when I was a kid when my parents obeyed God, but in the wintertime, when there was 3 feet of snow on the ground, and the construction was shut down, he was a construction worker, he had beans, and if he didn't shoot a deer, he had no meat. And, you know, you bought your clothes at Goodwill and did the best you could. There were other times it was good. I look back on those times of what some people would call poverty. I look back on those as good times. We learned a lot. We were a close family. It wasn't a bad time. It wasn't a bad time. Because God did something with it. Also, we'll say something else. Having wealth is a trial also. Now, I know what you're thinking. God, please give me that trial. Please give me the trial of wealth. But having wealth is as trying at times as not having wealth. I've sat down with people who make probably as much money as most of us in this room combined. And they've lost control of their money and, you know, they're claiming bankruptcy. And you think, how in the world could you do that? Well, when your house payment's $4,000 a month, when your car lease is $500 a month, they're spending whatever they bring in. And when you spend what you bring in, you eventually, or more than you bring in, you run out. It doesn't matter. The U.S. government is the richest, right? There's nothing more rich on the face of the earth than the U.S. government. And it's losing money so fast. I don't understand how the economy doesn't collapse. I don't understand it. There's no theory that explains why it keeps going, except it's too big to fall. It's just too big. There's too much activity going on. But you can't live in that kind of debt. Luke chapter 12. We'll get back to debt in a minute. Let's talk about faith here. Luke chapter 12. So we need to go back to remember these simple practical issues. This is a section of scripture that's been read so many times it becomes hackneyed, and it shouldn't because it's powerful. It's important for us not to take passages of scriptures like this and just, yeah, we read through it, we've read through it 100 times. Because this is very important in understanding if we're going to be able to deal with wealth or lack of wealth and have a clear mind. Verse 22, he said to his disciples, speaking of Jesus, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will put on. And of course, worry there, it's very interesting in the Greek. It's a powerful sense of anxiety based on the way you think. You're just thinking, almost like you're obsessed. You're obsessed with worry. Now, when you don't have, you know, you lose your job and you wonder where the, you're gonna, how you're going to pay your house payment or your, you know, your apartment payment next month. There's anxiety in that. That's normal. He's not saying we shouldn't feel anxiety when we're dealing with a stressful situation. What he's talking about is this obsessed anxiety that leaves us in fear. Because if you and I are driven by fear, and we view our financial situation in fear all the time, in anxiety all the time, eventually, just the way human nature is, we will find a way to compromise with God. Fear drives us, because fear is the opposite of faith. Fear drives us then to compromise with God. So it is anxiety, what we'll do is we'll work on the Sabbath, because we're filled with anxiety. Or because of this anxiety, we will go ahead and cheat on our taxes. Or because of this anxiety, we will make a business deal knowing that we're taking advantage of someone. And that anxiety, we will do all kinds of things which are against what God wants us to be as righteousness. So he's talking about this obsessive anxiety. He says, life is more than food and the body more than clothing. Now, if we stop there, it would be like Hinduism. Oh, don't worry about it. That's not what he's talking about. Don't. Just sit around in a loincloth and pray, and life, that's all life is about. That's not what he's saying. God gave us the universe and God gave us physical things, and God wants us to enjoy physical things. But we have to put everything into priority. We have to put everything into God's priorities. But we have to understand that sometimes being a Christian, well, no, always being a Christian has a price involved. There's a price involved. And sometimes those are physical things. He goes on, he says, consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than birds? That sentence, of how much more value are you than birds, is supposed to be a sentence of such hyperbole that it is shocking. You and I have heard it so many times, it doesn't mean anything. He's saying, now, think of a bird, and then God cares for birds. And who are you in the eyes of God? You are his children. If God cares for a bird, don't you think your value to God is a whole lot greater than that? And at this faith level, when it comes to obsessive anxiety over physical things and over money, we are forgetting God's, how the value we have before God. Now, the implication here is that there's going to be hard times, right? He didn't say, so what's your problem? You're never going to have a hard time. That's not what he says. He says, when you are worried and obsessed and anxious, just filled with anxiety over money, he says, remember how valuable you are to God, even in this situation. And which of you, by worrying, can add one cubit to his stature? If you then are not able to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field, and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? See, this is an issue of faith. And he's talking about this obsessive anxiety. Not the normal stress and anxiety we feel over the stresses of life, the problems of life. Losing a job, having financial problems, not knowing how to make your payment. What are you going to do? I had someone call me this week, was in a car accident, and said, how am I going to pay for my car? Well, we'll help you. A church member. And we were able to help pay for the car. Enough people chipped in, took them out of the church. Well, we all paid for the car. Paid the repairs. So the person keep going to work. But God didn't keep that person from going into a car wreck. And God didn't keep them from having cracked ribs. Stressful, painful, yes. But God took care of the person in the end. It wasn't how that person wished it would have worked out. Or even the rest of us. We wouldn't wish that on anybody. He goes on, he says, and do not seek what you should eat or what you should drink, nor have an anxious mind. For all these things the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knows that you need these things. Now, there are two important things here. The seeking has to do with service again. Who do you serve? Okay. Don't be like everybody else and serve food and drink and things. But then notice what he says. And your Father knows that you need these things. God doesn't want us to walk around starving, hungry, not able to, we come to church. Everybody knows that this is our church because everybody shows up and either beat up, run down 40-year-old cars with smoke pouring out of them. We all show up with bicycles. And we all are in tattered clothing, and we're poor. We're the poor of the world, and we want to. That's not what God wants us to be. Now, I'll tell you what. There will always be people in the congregation who are poor, right? And people who are poor to be accepted. Because it's not what you have, it's what you do with what you have. That's what God's concerned with. Then he goes on in verse 31, but seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Now at this point you think, okay, my anxiety is gone. I feel so much better. God's going to take care of me. And then the next statement comes out of the blue. Okay, you feel good now. God's going to take care of you. You're not so worried about money. Good. Sell what you have and give to the poor. Because give alms, that's what it means. Okay, sell what you have and give to the poor. Provide yourselves money bags which do not grow old. A treasure in heaven that does not fail. Where no thief approaches, nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He's back to the concept. Enjoy what you have. Use what you have. But let your real treasure be in your relationship and obedience to God. Because that is eternal. Any physical thing you have is short-lived. You see in the news this week, this man spent, I forget how many millions he spent building a yacht, and he took it out on its maiden voyage. I forget what harbor it was in. He's not very far out in the harbor, and you can see there's a hole in the bottom of the yacht, and water's coming up like a geyser. And it went out, there's this 85-foot yacht, and it just sort of rolled over. Now, I'm sure he had insurance, if you can afford $3-4 million yacht, you have insurance. But, he thought probably that was going to last in his lifetime. And he had the money to do it. And it sank. We have to remember that all physical things are good and wonderful from God. But, they're not eternal. They're not eternal. So this isn't, I'm not trying to make you all feel bad that maybe you have a nice car. No, that's a blessing from God. Or feel bad because you have a nice house. No, that's a blessing from God. Or that you have some nice clothes. Nor am I trying to make you feel bad if you say, wow, I'm having financial difficulties right now and I haven't had a new pair of shoes in a year. You shouldn't feel bad about that either. I say, that's part of life. And I guarantee you, no, I can't guarantee it because some people don't do this. Most of us are up here at one time and down here at another. Most of us have been at some time where we're doing okay. I mean, I don't think most of us are wealthy, but we do okay. You have a house, right? You have a car. You have a full belly. You're watching television. Wow. Physically speaking, you're compared to most people in the world, you're doing real good. Especially if you're a Spurs fan. But then you're watching the Spurs, okay? My wife's a Spurs fanatic. I can tell you something. You know, I got to share a trial I have. I think it's time to share something. During a Spurs game, I'm not allowed to talk. It's the strangest thing. You all think that's funny. I thought I'd get a little sympathy or something. I mean, dare I say, oh, bad shot, Timmy. Oh, my. You know, you can go watch this in the other room. What are you eating tomorrow for dinner? Let's go on. Okay, the second point. Faith. Okay, so money affects our faith. Now, these are broad concepts. This is a concept sermon, so I'm giving you broad concepts. I'll give you a few practical things at the end. Honesty. How we use our money affects our honesty. There's an old story about, it was a small town in the Old West where there was a farmer and a banker. And they were always at each other. And the farmer brought in just wagon loads of butter and sold it in 1 pound blocks to the baker. And the baker always said, hey, I get perfect scales here and you are 1 ounce short. And he kept bringing it in and saying, No, they're not. They're a pound. So finally, the baker sued him and brought him before the local magistrate. And they brought out some scales, and the judge was there, and they, sure enough, all the butter was 1 ounce short. And he said to the farmer, he said, well, are you doing this on purpose? And he said, no. He says, do you have any scales that you use? And he says, well, yeah, but they're not really accurate like these. He said, well, what do you do? What do you use for a scale? He said, well, it's very easy. He says, I just buy a 1 pound loaf of bread from the baker, and I use that to measure my car. See, it's very easy to say somebody else is dishonest. It's very easy to see dishonesty in other people. But we need to be very careful about our own dishonesty. Proverbs 21:6 says, getting treasure by a lying tongue is the fleeting fantasy of those who seek death. I see more people get burned by get-rich-quick schemes. I see people compromise with their own honesty and not even realize they're doing it. You know, when you work for somebody, say, if you have a 40-hour-a-week job, and that person pays you, I don't care if it's minimum wage. If you hired on for 40 hours a week and you don't do that, you're stealing that person's time. And you're stealing that person's money. See, this is a point of character. You say, well, I only make minimum wage. Big deal. No, that's not the point, is it? The point is, it's who you are. I don't care whether you make $3 an hour or $1,000 an hour. Your character is what you do with that hour. See, we measure by, well, they're only paying me minimum wage. It was what, $8.50? But I don't know what minimum wage is. They're only paying me minimum wage, $8 to $9. Hey, what do you expect from me? If you want more, pay me $20. Nah. Your righteousness demands I give everything I have. I give $100 an hour, even if you're only paying me $8. I give, for that hour, you get my full work. But see, we don't think that way. Because if you do that at $8 an hour, you won't stay at $8 an hour. If you give everything, you eventually will be making more. Because that effort will motivate you, will motivate others to see what you do and say, hey, I want you at my place. Or, hey, I want to give you a raise. It may take a while. But also, you go home at the end of the day, no matter what you're doing, you go home at the end of the day with a sense of accomplishment. I have to say, when I do counseling with young males, in the church and out of the church, that come and just want to do counseling about life situations, I always tell them something. I'm going to tell you a basic principle of life. I learned this one time because I was at a camp and I had a bunch of boys. They had a cleaned bathhouse. The toilets were all stuffed up and it was a mess. I mean, it was a mess. And they were going to do it. They used to, you know, I had this general rebellion on the counselors couldn't get them to do it. And I came and I said, gentlemen, this is simple. This is life. You want to succeed in life? You clean some toilets every once in a while. That's the way it works. Well, let somebody else do it. I said, there is nobody else. There's you. Now, you want success, you want to go on to softball after this, then we clean the toilets. If you don't want success, you can sit here all day. You can sit here and be lazy all day. But I would go clean toilets. And I put gloves on and went in. Well, pretty soon, I looked, they all trickle in, and pretty soon they all feel, okay, I'm telling them what to do, we clean the toilets. Years later, a man came up to me and said, hey, I remember who he was, said hi to him. He says, you know, I own a multi-million dollar business, doing quite well. He says, you know why? I have no idea. He says, because when I was a kid, some man told me I was going to have to clean toilets. And he says, I realized that's what I was going to do in life. And he was valuable because he became valuable. You see what I mean? This has to do with character. Don't steal from your employer. Because you're stealing from yourself. Work. Give a full day's work. No. Whatever they pay you, give them a little more. Give them more than what they pay you. Whoever, whatever it is, give them more than what they pay you. Also, I have to say this is a problem sometimes in the church. In the world, when you exchange money, services, and goods for other money, services, and goods, right, on a contract, you buy something, you sell something, you exchange one service for another. It's called an agreement. And there's obligations with that. And you're considered dishonest if you do not fulfill your obligations. Families don't do that. Hey, I'll come by tomorrow and Mom, and I'll mow the grass for you at 10. Okay, good. Come on by and... let me give you a better example. I'll come by and mow that field for you and for free. And if I can use the grass I cut to go feed my horses. Then this is starting to get a real life situation. The person says, okay, I'll be at 10 o'clock Monday morning. Great. I get my field cut, you get your, right? We have an agreement. 10 o'clock comes, the person's waiting around, and they never show 11 o'clock, noon, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. They waste the whole day waiting for the person to come. So they forget about it. A week later, the person shows up. Well, they've already now had somebody else cut the field. The person says, well, what are you doing? You said I could cut the field. They said, well, yeah, you told me last Monday. I wasted my whole day waiting for you. Yeah, but you're in the church. You should have kept it for me. There's a problem here. You wouldn't treat somebody in the world like that. But sometimes in the church, we will not uphold our ends of contracts because we say, they'll understand, they're a Christian. That's dishonest. And that is defrauding a brother. We have a responsibility. I mean, how much more should it be with a Christian? You wouldn't treat a Hindu that way. How do we treat each other that way? When we make agreements with each other, we should do everything we can. You know, if you can't be there, you call the person and say, hey, my truck broke down, they're going to understand, right? But we actually, as we'll treat each other like, I see, you know, fathers and sons and brothers all do this kind of stuff. They'll set up agreements and we'll do it. Dad and family, they'll understand. No, they don't. Then there's some families that don't talk to each other for 10 years because of those kinds of things. We have the church, our obligations, our honesty. That's how we treat each other in our agreements. That's part of it. The third point is work ethic. This is the whole subject in itself, of itself. I've given young adult seminars on work ethic. In fact, I've given sermons in the past on work ethic. Work ethic is your ethical commitment to do the work at hand. You know, I read years ago a survey of hundreds of businesses of what these managers saw as the most important qualities in people they hired. I thought it would be talent, right? Experience and talent. It wasn't. You know what it was? They show up to work on time, and they do what they're supposed to do, in the way they're supposed to do it, in the time allotted. And it didn't matter whether it was a janitor or executive, that was what everybody was looking for. They come to work on time. They do what they're supposed to do. So in other words, they do have the skills and talents to do that. And they do it in the way they were told. I wish I had a dollar for every time someone said, I lost my job this week. I said, well, why? Oh, well, you know this manager I have? He told me to do such and such, and it was just the stupidest way you could think of. And I just told him, that's stupid. He said, well, do it that way anyways. And I said, no. And I went and did it my way, and he fired me. And my way was better than his. Well, who pays your... Well, I just won't do stupid things. Okay, I hope you have long unemployment benefits. Because you're not going to be able to hold down a job. Work ethic. You know, there's an interesting scripture in 2 Thessalonians. The church of Thessalonica was having a problem with this. This very issue, and it's how Paul dealt with it. I think it's so interesting. 2 Thessalonians 3:7. Paul had lived in Thessalonica for a while. He's writing back to them about some problems they were having in the congregation. And he says, for you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. Now, Paul was there with a number of other men that were with him when he lived there. And he said, now, I want you to remember what we did. Because he's going to tell them, I did this as an example for you. Because there was a problem in that congregation. For did we eat anywhere, nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we did not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. So he said, when I was there, remember, I not only served you as your minister, I worked another job to pay my own way. I worked another job to pay my own way. He says, I did this as an example. Because why? What was the problem? Why would Paul do that? Verse 10, for even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Wow. That is not a popular message in today's world. Now, I want you to stress here. He didn't say, if someone's out of work, if someone just, for some reason, maybe they're on a fixed income, maybe they don't have the ability to make more than a certain amount of money. Maybe they did make a mistake and get fired. You know, in other words, these are people who are willing to work, but for some reason they're not working or can't bring enough money, especially widows and older people who can't bring enough money. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about a very specific kind of person. A person who will not work. They just don't want to work. Can you imagine... In our society today, a law that said, if you will not work, you don't get any government aid. We would have violence. Now remember, this isn't people who are really in need. And he's not even talking about people who made a mistake and are in need. That's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about people who are underemployed. He's talking about people who just refuse to work. and we'll do it. He goes on, he says, For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all. He says, not even trying to get a job, but they are busybodies. Now those who are such, we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. Remember one of the amazing things in the New Testament or Old Testament, and that's why we have to realize that our capitalistic system is not the system of the Old Testament. There's bits and pieces that are part of the way God sets up an economic system, but it's not entirely capitalistic. It's not entirely socialistic either. But the idea that when you plow your field, you leave the corners for the poor. Today we would say, how dare anybody require that? That's my field. God said, no. You have a right to wealth. I gave you the privilege of wealth. You will share your corners with the poor. You know what's really I find interesting? The poor had to go harvest it. They didn't harvest it and take it to the poor. The poor had to go work. But it was there for them. It's an interesting concept. It's not anything like human beings come up with. So the person who had been given the privilege of wealth worked hard, kept the wealth, but they also left the quarters of their field so that the poor could come harvest for themselves. Which brings us to the fourth point. So we see that money affects our work ethic, and work ethic affects our money. Money affects our generosity. Money affects our generosity. Generosity, I'm going to make a simple statement here. Generosity produces more happiness than stinginess. Generosity produces more happiness than stinginess does. It's just, have you ever met somebody who's truly, truly stingy? And are they happy? Some of the most stingiest people in the world I've ever worked with were just so unhappy. And they live thinking everybody's out to take advantage of them. I worked for a guy like that one time. That man thought everybody was out to take advantage of him. He wasn't a happy guy. And he pitched and his son was the same way. I remember they were driving through West Texas, and I forget what town they were going through, but there was a drought. And so you had to ask for water, and the restaurant was charging a nickel for all the water you could drink, but they were charging a nickel because of the drought, and they had a sign. And he was so mad he wouldn't eat there. He just sat there while everybody else ate, because I'm not going to pay a nickel for a glass of water. It was that stinky. You know, I'm owed water. Actually, you're not. It's this guy's water. You know. Let me read some Proverbs to you. Proverbs 14:31. He who oppresses the poor reproaches his maker, but he who honors him has mercy on the needy. In other words, him there being God. We have a moral obligation to help people in need. We do. So, you know, the flip side of this is somebody who does not work, then we have a moral obligation that person has to learn to work. But many other people, and it's so easy for us to judge that. That person's been out of work for 3 months. They don't need any help. He needs to get a job. Let me ask you something. You ever been out of work for an extended period of time and couldn't get a job? I mean, you try and you try and you try and you can't get a job. And then everybody's saying, that person, then you're depressed because you can't get a job. They just doesn't get a job. We've got to be real careful about how we judge things. You know? Now, like I said, there are people that don't work. I've seen people that will go into a congregation, stay in someone's house for 6 months, and the person finally say, I can't take you anymore, care of you anymore, and literally go into somebody else's house for 6 months. And they go, I can't take care of you anymore. They go to somebody else's house for 6 months. Then you call the pastor from the last place they lived. They said, oh, yeah, they lived here for 3 years. They stayed with 8 different people until finally nobody else would take care of them, so they moved on. There have been rare occasions where we've actually found people who will go from congregation to congregation and haven't worked for years. Because we're generous people, we feed them, we house them, we take care of them. And then they move on to another congregation. Proverbs 22:9. He who has a generous eye will be blessed, for he gives his bread to the poor. Proverbs 21:13. Whoever shuts his ears to the cry of the poor will also cry himself and be not heard. Proverbs 29:7. The righteous considers the cause of the poor, but the wicked does not understand such knowledge. Let's remember this. Now, sometimes some of the most generous people I have met are people who were poor themselves. They might only have two pairs of shoes, but you get one of them. I have seen people like that. I grew up in Appalachia, and he was poor. And there were people who were like that. You know, one guy would squeeze a nickel so much he wouldn't buy, you know, he's a millionaire, he won't buy a glass of water, he won't eat. And I've seen people give, you know, food off their plate to another person. Generosity is a spiritual issue. Aren't you glad God is generous? I mean, what did we see in the slide presentation this morning? This afternoon. What did we see? God's generosity. I've made everything. I'm going to give it all to you. I'm going to give. He doesn't have to give us anything. What do we deserve from God? Nothing. Yeah, I'm going to give it to you. That's just generosity. Our money affects our generosity, how we use our money. And the last point is our contentment. We have to have the drive to want to do more, to work hard. It's not wrong to say, you know what? I want a new car, and I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to buy this car. And if you have the ability to do that, you work hard, you buy the car, that's good. That's a character trait. That's work ethic. Of course, always remember this, too. You buy the car. Oh, man, that new car smell. Now, I have never bought a new car, but I like it when they smell the new car, you know, spray the new car smell in it when you buy it. That's sort of nice. So you get the new car, it smells so good, it runs so good, everything's perfect. And then, you know, when the kids throw up in the car. Or it breaks down. You know, the car I have, I love this car. I've had it for 4.5 years. But, you know, it's got some miles on it. And the seats are starting to get sort of worn. That's my car. But you ever have a car that you bought that you loved, and a year later you wish someone would steal it? You would pay somebody to steal my car. I'm going to take, well, I have no insurance on it, and put it, you know, go outside and break a window and leave the keys in it so somebody else can. But you still owe money on it. You can't do that. Contentment is enjoying good things and nice things, and also living with the fact that nothing stays the same. Things wear out, things break down. What's new now, 2 years from now, will be old. And part of the problem is we have a hard time with contentment in this society because we are so wealthy. I mean, every time you're contented with someone or with something, you turn on the television and they tell you it's outdated. Right? I lost track of this, you know, the smartphones and the, you know, 2.2, 2.9, 3.0, 8.6. But, you know, it's like, and pretty soon it's like they've had 57 varieties in 3 years. And they keep convincing us to buy more and buy more and buy more. Computers, everything. Cars. Now they have cars, you know, with sensors that can tell you if you're going to run into something. You know what that is? That's just something more to break down. I had a car that broke down one time, and I had them come and take it off to the Ford dealer, and then all this would cost me lots of money. And they came back and said, no, it won't cost you a thing. And what was it? Because the transmission wouldn't work. It was a sensor. A sensor told the car, it told the motor that the transmission was broken. So the car would work. So I'm stuck on the side of the road, miss half a day of work, you know, have to leave my car overnight someplace to find out there's nothing wrong with my car. The car told itself there was something wrong with it. Anyways, I can see you're about as interested in that as you were about my wife telling me I had to be quiet during Spurs games. 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6. Contentment. Did I just read this?
No.
What happens? You know, when you give the same sermon twice in the same day, you get deja vu. And it's like, wait a minute, I just read this. No, I didn't just read this. Verse 6 of 1 Timothy 6. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. Godliness with contentment is happiness. It's great gain. It makes life worth living. Things break down, you feel bad about it. Your suit wears out. Your dress wears out. That your favorite dress. And it just wears out. And we learn to be content with the state we're in, where we are. Sometimes you get new things, sometimes you don't. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we will carry out nothing, or nothing else. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, from which some have strayed from their faith in greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But you, O man, this young minister is talking to, you, O man of God, flee these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness. He doesn't say the love of money is the root of all things, a root of all evil. I think that's what it says in the Old King James. This is a much better translation. Almost all translations translate it this way. The Greek intent was that the love of money is a root of evil. There's more than one root of evil. Once again, he's talking about serving money, isn't he? I know I've said this so many times, but I worked in advertising. The whole thing is to trick you and force you into thinking there's something wrong with you if you don't buy this. It's to make you feel bad to buy something. Or you will feel good if you buy it. You know, remember jellies? Women, do you remember jellies? They were a type of shoe that came out in the 1980s. Mid-80s. Okay. And they were jellies. I worked for a radio station. Jellies were $2.99 or $3.99 a pair. Little rubbery plastic shoes that were bright colored. Well, we started running advertising for it, for this one company. And all these girls ran, all the high school girls ran and bought them. Well, tipping point formed. The high school kids bought them, but the young adults bought them. And then the little kids bought them. And they ran out. So we advertised more. And they ran it again. So we raised worked with the advertiser, $5.99. And they ran out again. We were selling jellies for $15.99 a pair until we saturated the market. Oh, he made a killing. And after he couldn't sell anymore, guess what they sold? $3.99 a pair. Because that's all they were really worth. That's what advertising does. Every grown women, everybody in that town had to have jellies. It was amazing. They were purple. They were pink. They were all these bright colors, and they were just little. Did you ever have a pair of jellies? No. Okay. You didn't seem like a jelly person. But there's jellies. I mean, they were $3.99 shoes. Huh? They were uncomfortable. Yeah. That's like flat plastic bottoms. And we were selling them for $15.99 a pair, which I don't know what it would be today. It'd be at least double. $32 a pair for flat plastic shoes that you would buy now at the dollar store? And that's what we were able to do. And everybody had to have one because they were so cool. And then it was like, oh, these are uncomfortable. And besides, I have three pairs. Yeah, $15.99. That's all pure profit. From $3.99 to $15.99. Because they were making profit at $3.99. Contentment. We learn to be content with what God is doing in our lives. Now, real quick here in the last 5 minutes then. Principles for some money management. One, someone told me this years ago, it's an old saying, but it's so true. Live today like it's your last day and plan as if you're going to live to be 100. Live today like it's your last day, but plan as if you're going to live to be 100. In Proverbs 6, 6 to 11, it says, go to the ant, you sluggard, because she prepares. You read that little passage there, it's, look, ants gather food and they last through the winter. Human beings sit around and then in the middle of the winter wonder why they don't have any food. And at the end of that, those Proverbs there, he says, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall your poverty come on you like a prowler and your need like an armed man. Now, just because Jesus said we shouldn't be anxious about this future doesn't mean we shouldn't plan for the future. If you're going to plan for the future, you have to have financial goals. You know, if you're going to plan to spend $40,000 a year, you better go get a job making $40,000 a year. If you're going to spend $80,000 a year, you better go get a job making $80,000 a year. You have to plan. Most people just go through life willy-nilly, not even knowing what's going on. You know, but a little story I put in the pastor's update last night. You know, you're in an airport or an airplane, and the pilot comes on and says, "I have some bad news and some good news." The bad news is our direction finder is down, the computer's down, and we have no idea where we're going. But the good news, we have a tailwind, and we're going there at 600 miles an hour. That's how most people live their lives. You have to plan what you want to do financially. Now, sometimes you say, how important are certain things? Sometimes people want lots of money and they get a job or they make lots of money and they hate it because they hate to go into work every day. They hate it. Other people say, hey, I don't care what my career is as long as I need this amount of money because that meets my goals, and they're happy doing whatever. But you have to plan. And it's never too late to start planning. Okay? It's never too late to start planning. There's short-term goals and long-term goals. I mean, financial planning is important. Two, be real careful about borrowing money. Proverbs 22:7 says, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. You know, the greatest threat to your financial security is your credit card. Save your money and buy it with cash if possible. Now, you can't always buy everything with cash. You get a house has to be financed, the car has to be financed. Usually. But it is better to save your money. You want the big screen TV, and you go in debt, and you buy it, and 2 years later you want a bigger screen TV, but you're still paying on your credit card at 22% interest. So you get rid of that and buy another one, and now you got more money on there. I have seen people put themselves in bankruptcy, people who make a whole lot more money than most of us, because they lived above their means. It's simple. You live above your means, you run out of money. It's simple. And credit cards will do that. And at the exorbitant, interest that they charge. You know, one thing you can do, sometimes you see, especially they'll do this with furniture, no interest. So you save the money, go ahead and put it on, no interest for 2 years, but you already have the money, so you get to use your money and make interest off of your money. Well, you're off of their money. That's what they're doing to you all the time. Of course, you're getting, 1/4 of 1%, and they're getting 22%. It's a huge difference. By the way, God was upset with ancient Israel because it's sort of they were charging each other 1% interest. He considered that to be robbery. So what does he think of a system that serves 22 to 27% interest? He has a little different viewpoint of certain things than we do. Now, he did believe that the Bible does have set up for investment, but that's a whole other subject. You can invest and make money or lose money, but you're doing that as an investment. But charging that kind of interest is against the law of God. Because it actually forces people into poverty. I have been in bankruptcy court with widows whose husband died and did not know how to manage their money and just kept running things up on credit card. And you go in and well, you got $30,000 on this credit card, $18,000 on this credit card, and $6,000 on this credit card, and how much money do you bring in? Well, I'm on Social Security, I get $1,200 a month. And so, the judge says, you are bankrupt. And you now are bankrupt, you have no, a bad credit rating, and you say, well, you can't get a car, you can't get any loans, but you know what happens invariably in every case I've dealt with? Within 3 months, the credit card company contacts them and says, hey, do you want a credit card? So, be real careful about borrowing money. Which brings to a third point is, be careful about lending money or co-signing for others' debts. Proverbs 22, verse 26 and 27 says, do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? In other words, if you co-sign for someone, what the proverb says is, you make sure you're prepared and expect to lose it. So if you go co-sign for someone for $10,000, you have to be prepared to lose $10,000. If you can't afford to lose the $10,000, don't co-sign. That's what the proverb says. Or you could lose your bed. That's the way it works. And then the last point in these practical points. You have to get control of your money. And that means you have to learn to budget. And it has to be written down. Don't get yourself a budget book, a ledger, just like they use it in businesses. And you budget out how much money you bring in, and you keep track of wherever every cent goes. I sit down with people, I'm not a financial expert, but I can help set up a budget. You sit down and you help set up a budget, and someone will say, well, wait a minute, you're bringing this amount of money, where's this money going? Well, I don't know. Wait a minute, you're losing $25 a week, which works out to be roughly $100 a month, which works out roughly to be $1,200 a year. You're losing $1,200 a year. Where is it? I don't know. Well, what do you spend your cash on? Well, I do go to Starbucks every morning, and I get myself a grande. How much is it? $4.97. That's $1,200 a year. Now, if you have enough money to do that, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Most of us don't. We don't even know where the money goes, see? We spend it, and we don't know where it goes. I get to do that once a week. Once every 2 weeks. No, but you do it once in a while. But to do it every day. To do it every day. I tell this story. This happened so many years ago. I can't even remember who the person is. I mean, this is the confidentiality issue. I deal with a family, we're sitting down, we're going through budget issues. Finally realized, they said, wait a minute, you're losing like $3,000 a year, where's it going? Hey, what do you buy? I don't buy anything but beer. Beer, yeah. So how long have you been an alcoholic? How do you know that? We're spending $3,000 a year on beer, that's how I know that. We got to work through this problem. Your budget is really not to raise your problem here. You got another issue that we need to work with. It's a serious spiritual issue. So budgeting and actually keeping track of every cent. Sometimes I've asked people, just write down every cent that you spend. I don't care whether it's 50 cents. Write it down. See where all your money goes. And a lot of times, we're just letting it just. We're drinking it away at coffee, or we're using it for lunches that we could find a cheaper way to do it, or we're doing it on our cable system, because we have to have Netflix and our cable and this and all and that. You're spending $200 a month on your entertainment system. That's fine if you have the money to do it. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying if you don't have the money to do it, you can't do it. We have to prioritize where we're going to spend our money, and you'll never do that until you get control of it, and you'll never do that until you budget. Budget, get out of debt. Those are the two most important things to getting control of your money. I know someone in San Antonio that decided to do that about five years ago. Budget, get out of debt. The family will pay off their house. They like a 20-year mortgage. They'll pay off their house sometime next year. And they already own their car. And they're going to have more money to spend than what you and I could ever dream of. Simply because they struggled. 5 years is hard. They're out of debt. And they love you. It is important, whatever your present financial state, remember, money affects all aspects, or many aspects, of our spirituality. We just mentioned five today. Faith, honesty, work ethic, generosity, and contentment. Having wealth or not having wealth. They're actually both tests of spiritual character. We didn't go through all the scriptures that where God tells the wealthy that their obligations, or tell the poor their obligations. That's interesting too. The Bible contains all kinds of obligations for the poor. Which means there's always going to be poor, and there's always going to be wealthy, and there's always going to be people in between. Until Christ comes back. So remember, Jesus taught that how we handle our physical wealth, it's a training ground. It's part of the testing. To see how we will handle the blessings, how we're going to handle the real blessings, how we're going to handle the universe when God gives that to us.